So we're here at Gen Con with Andy Gollums and Bruce Cordell with Wizards of the Coast. How's it going, guys?
Great.
Really good.
So first thing, Andy, we got to follow up with one thing way back. D&D XP before the game was even released.
So D&D Experience 2008.
Yes.
Casting me back a year and a half.
A year and a half.
It's supposed to remember things from that long
ago.
Yeah. We'll remind you.
It's all on the web, so it's up there forever, you know. So we asked you about the monk, and we said, oh, it's a martial striker. And you were like, that's at least half wrong. And it's true. You ended up not lying to us about that.
Yay!
It's also, I think, interesting that you said you really wanted it to be like the guy who like flipped off walls and did like awesome kung fu moves and stuff. Do you think you succeeded in that final?
I think we did. I think the new power archetype that we pioneered with the monk that you can see in the playtest version that's still up, the full discipline that essentially combines moves with attacks, means that character has extra incentive to be pulling cool acrobatic stunts because it's right there in the power. Well, I'm using this attack, I might as well be doing this backflip or this charge or what have you. So, yeah, I'm pretty pleased. I haven't had the opportunity to play with a monk yet. I only have so many campaigns, and I'm still enjoying my teleporting sword mage too much, as well as my warlord, who's loosely based on Ben Edlund's The Tick character. Because I thought that's a great high...
He has a battle cry already built in.
High charisma, low wisdom leader.
Right.
But yeah, as going back to the monk, I think that that combination of moves and attacks really sets him apart from other characters and incents him to do exactly those sorts of stunts that I've always wanted to see happen.
Cool. So, Bruce, you were the psionics guy in 3rd edition for sure, and some of that's carried through, obviously. What do you think about the monk joining psionics?
Well, I was part of the discussion when that occurred. It kind of was going back and forth for a while because we were wondering what to do with key. You know, monk should be key. That being K-I, not K-E-Y. But it just seemed like there wasn't enough to hang an entire power source on key. And obviously the monk is very much a mental discipline sort of fellow. There's a lot of practice, there's a lot of mental thought in order to invoke his key, which is basically a type of psionic power, we decided, and it actually flowed pretty naturally. And if you've got an opportunity to download the monk playtest, and now the psion playtest, you can see that the way the monk uses psionics is actually quite a bit different than the way the psion uses psionics. So even though he is part of the psionic power source, we managed to really separate the feel of how the monk does it than the Scion and some of the other character classes in that far source to it. So, to make a long story shorter, I really like how the monk turned out quite a bit. And I'm very happy that he or she turned up in the psionic power source.
So with, I know you can't talk about it because it's Player's Handbook 3 and all that stuff, but because they have such different feels, the Scion and the monk, but they're part of the same power source, we sort of expect to see some like mechanical difference between a lot of the stuff there, like between the different...
I'd like to say that sort of a more general sense that in any given power source, we're willing to experiment with different ways of carrying out powers, right? That we see the power source as primarily serving a story function in the game, that it helps tie those classes. When it can give us a mechanical link, we like to take advantage of that, but only if it sort of feels natural, doesn't have to be forced too much, right? I'm trying to think of a good example. Right? We wouldn't necessarily say, well, all arcane characters are good at summoning monsters, so therefore we have to wedge that into every arcane class, and no other classes can ever do it. That actually restricts design in ways that we're not really too interested in doing, because we might come up with a great summoning type class that would be perfect for the shadow power source, but oh, we just gave that away to Arcane. Now either we have to make up something else that works just like it but has a different name, or we have to discard a really good concept.
I'd like to follow up on that. I'm not necessarily saying you'll see anything like this in Player's Handbook 3, or you will or you won't, but the very fact that we've shown that we can use power points in these two pretty different ways for these two character classes, I mean, pretty much opens the door for us to use power points in a whole variety of different ways in the future. I mean, it's kind of exciting to think about what we could do with power points if they're this flexible mental jolt that you know, just measure with 1, 2, 3 power points. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, I would say that the 4th edition fans like didn't see it coming at all, that you were going to put power points back in the game and do something that radically different with the power system. You know,
take out and counter powers
and then put power points back in.
Something I'd like to ask is sort of an insight into the design process that you guys go through. How did you go about discussing the elimination of the key power source and the possible fan reaction to that? How much does that play in? How do you guys discuss it?
It's certainly something we take very seriously, right? I mean, we know that we're not creating a game from scratch. There is a legacy of what's come before that we have to be cognizant of. But at the same time, we also have to make sure that that legacy doesn't restrict us from making the decisions that are the best for the future of the game. And there are times, obviously people have seen them already, just with the debut of the 4th edition Player's Handbook last year. There are places where we went away from the legacy of the game because we thought this is the best long-term solution for the game. This is getting the most people playing, having the most fun for the longest time. But, I mean, those conversations are constant.
Yeah, people love key, right? And part of the conversation was, remember how much people liked Oriental Adventures, right? And that just, to some people, that meant, of course, there will be a key power source book in the future. But one of the things we have to constantly do is examine our assumptions about what's going to happen just because it seems like that's what we're going to do. We need to say, is that what we're really going to do? Let's think about this. How many other classes can we put on the key power source?
Whereas turning it into just, well, here's a list of the classes you'd find in a Japanese or Chinese style game, right? We didn't want the power sources to become cultural power sources. I think Mike made a really good comment. You wouldn't want the martial power source to be, well, that's Western European, so we've got a mountebank and a cleric and a knight, and they're all in the same power source because that's the you know, medieval French power source.
Mountebank's a pretty cool class name, though, I gotta say. Do they all get the cape for free?
Absolutely. So they can and the other thing about key is that it's clearly not gone from the game, right? The monks are still users of it. So the legacy of that idea remains in the monk. And in fact, folks here this weekend who are signing up for D&D Insider are getting coming to the realization that the monk is not the only class in the game that is using key. We're passing out a sample version of the assassin that's going to be debuting on D&D Insider as an exclusive class, I think next month. And folks are going to go, hey, wait a minute. This looks like this guy's using key too. And he's a totally different power source. So that's another mechanical wrinkle we want to say, look, mechanics can also cross power sources. The same concept can be reflected in multiple classes. Because there's mechanics and story that go with that idea. Now you've got this sort of lattice work of ideas rather than just rows and silos.
Branching on that, do you think power points or anything similar would ever jump to different power sources?
I could see it happening. I mean, it would have to be a really good reason for us to do it. We wouldn't do it just for the sake of doing it. But, I mean, right. Bruce and Mike and the other designers talk about how they combine stuff all the time.
Yeah, I mean, like Andy said, though, I mean, we wouldn't want to just do it and say, woohoo! I mean, maybe we would, but we wouldn't publish it, you know, because that would be confusion for no real good reason. But
I mean, we start concepting work on Player's Handbook 4 in, like, 2 or 3 months. Player's Handbook is pretty much an annual cycle now for us. We don't really count time in months or seasons, it's simply what state the current Player's Handbook is in.
And in some ways, Player's Handbook 4 has already been in concept, actually, yeah. But yeah, no one's got time on their schedule, but, you know, certainly sitting around talking, sitting bag ideas.
Is it ever tough because you work so far ahead to, like, keep track of what's going on or, like, what's...
Very difficult, right? I can't count the number of times when I've said, hey, have you looked at this thing in Draconomicon? And the person looks at me like, well, no, that went off to typesetting. That book's done. No, the third one, not the second one. Right? so the numbering can throw us. I now just have started referring to books without numbers at all because I always get them wrong.
You like the player's handbook with the druid in it.
It's the player's handbook that's in editing, not the one that's in design.
So about the power sources more, while you're saying they're more of a story-based thing, there's still some mechanical hallmarks of them, right? How much of that is intentional to try to get them to flow together?
I'm not sure I understand your question exactly, but when I was involved in the player's handbook 3 design, the fellows who had been involved in Player's Handbook 2 said, you know, we had such great results with coming up with a story first for Player's Handbook 2. We need to do this every single time and then let the mechanics fall from that. And so that's when we came up with Psionic Power Source. We said, well, why is this Psionic Power Source here? What's going on? And then many mechanical decisions then came from that. I mean, we had some ideas we're going to have PowerPoints, right? But how they were actually used and some of the power names, many of the power names and many of the Paragon paths and stuff like that, came together because we had a story finally, and not just mechanics.
PowerPoints are certainly a very unsubtle version of something shared mechanically. A little less subtle, a little more subtle one, I should say, it was in the primal classes in Player's Handbook 2, where we tried to imagine each class as having some sort of transformational aspect, which manifested in different ways. The barbarian's rages transformed him in one way. The druid obviously transforms very physically using the shape-changing. And the other classes each sort of tied to that concept. Like, I am using my primal energy to transform my shape and aspects in some way. And that was something that most other classes really didn't deal with at all. Would we never do a transformational thing in another class? No, but it was a nice hook for the primal classes so that the druid and the barbarian eventually go, oh, I see how we're connected, both sort of mechanically and in the world.
Well, they also get a lot of similar power names and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, again, it was a great way where story can link them together.
Now, do you see that carrying through to the Player's Handbook 3 with the same primal story, or would the primal characters latch on to the Player's Handbook 3 story with the psionics?
Both of those would be open options.
Okay.
Right? We have with the non-psionic classes in PH3, we've explored some new mechanical territory that people haven't seen, and we've also done a little sort of gap filling of, look, this needs to be here, people are calling for this kind of combo, let's explore that. So it's always a balancing act between those various things. You're juggling what's the story, what's the mechanics, how does it work in the game, how does it work in its power source, who's going to want to play it. Those are all up in the air as you're designing and developing these classes. Our classes aren't ever really done until they're leaving editing, right? They're often significant changes as we sort of work those puzzle pieces in, happening months after Bruce and the design team have finished, with their input, right? It's not black box to them, but we'd be calling them back and say, okay, we need a meeting about this class. It's just not working yet, right? The mechanics are there, but why is he doing this stuff? And we'll hammer on that some more until we have a nice finished piece.
We're really blessed with having a really strong editorial team that has, you know, really good editorial chops, but also a really fantastic sound grasp of game mechanics. I mean, they bring out so much in the game. It's like, oh yeah, thank you for bringing that out. I'm actually in a game with two of them. So it's like, they know their stuff. I'm like, okay, whatever you say.
So along the lines of that process, how did the whole Psionic Core Realm connection, how did that sort of come out?
I did not suggest it.
Uh-huh.
I did not. I was in the room when it was suggested, and I went with it because, you know, I was happy to go there, but I just wanted
You're
to
like,
know.
Oh, the Far Realm, who wants that?
I know people are going to assume that because I was on Psionics and because the Far Realm came into the story, it's like, well, Bruce must have suggested that. No, I think Mike suggested that, actually, Mike Merles. But once we had the suggestion in place, it's like, okay, let's see, why would that be? And the story seemed to be that this Far Realm was this slowly, if you look at it edition-wise even, it's a slowly encroaching thing that started off as just a blip on the consciousness of most D&D players.
Like one monster in the first Monster Manual, the Mind Flayer, right? Was sort of the iconic forerunner of this idea.
Yeah, and then
over
slowly...
the years you get, oh, here's Aboleth. So I guess the Beholder's in the first one, too.
Right, but still, it's just kind of a niggling little bit. And then it kind of gave the impression that something was slowly moving into the consciousness, the collective unconsciousness of D&D. And we thought, well, maybe there's some sort of immune response in the collective unconsciousness, and that's psionic power to go against the psionic power of the Far Realm. And from here and there, people were waking psionic power. First edition, it was just kind of this crazy, you know, you have a chance to have psionic power, there you go. And, you know, that's not part of the story, but that's kind of the meta story, the first edition, the second edition, third edition. And the real story is, you know, little people slowly have been waking over the generations to psionic power, and you know, maybe at some future date, still to be determined, there'll be some great battle between the assembled soldiers of people who have woken to the psionic power and the Far Realm, and we'll see what the Far Realm converts.
It seemed a very intuitive and natural fit, right? The psionic powers are sort of most common in those types of monsters, right? Mind Flayer being a very iconic one, but there have been many others, Aboleths and things like that, that have at various points in time been characterized as psionic. So it seemed like rather than fight that, we want to embrace it. That's something that we've done a lot in 4th edition, is look back at the world of the game works in this way. This is A, B, and C are true. Rather than trying to hide that or just ignore it, let's embrace it and see where we go, right? What happens if we really talk about, well, the elves and the drow split apart in this cataclysmic event that shattered the races? Well, maybe that's the reason why we need to highlight the Eladrin as an entirely separate race and to use that story, and really embrace that story as a core part of the D&D world. It's not just something that maybe happened. It is absolutely something that has happened in functionally every D&D world in the universe. And it gave rise to these races.
At the same time, do you consider things like there was sort of like the at least perceived pseudo-scientific feel of older psionics, and there's that kind of thing that existed before that maybe you wanted to work on. Does that also figure into that decision when like making a new story for psionics and that
we third edition, we tried to slowly pull it back to the science fiction feel to greater or lesser success. And fourth edition, even more so. We reversed power names and stuff like that. You know, just they were just too blatantly too science fiction feel for that we wanted to.
We don't want to be using a lot of words like psychokinesis and uber metabolism and things like that. They pull you out of the shared world of D&D. I don't think we're necessarily 100% there. I mean, people might argue whether telepathy is a science fiction word or whether it's fantasized enough. So there's still some gray areas.
It's like that fine line that, you know, bookstores have the same problem with if they're trying to classify.
Right. Where do I shelve this book? It's got robots and dinosaurs. Right.
But at some point, right, it's mental power, and to some people that's always going to be science fiction, and that you can't get, it's like, okay, this is where we're going to have to stop and work with it.
Yeah, what we're hoping is that folks will be able to come to the psionic story with fresh eyes and look at it, not necessarily for what it's been before, but what it is here. Certainly there are a lot of legacy things that we've brought along to make it a familiar experience. But we also know that there are plenty of places where we've just said, you know what, that part of psionics, we're just not using that anymore. It just doesn't quite work for the story or for the game mechanics. You know, we certainly didn't want people rolling randomly whether they got eight extra powers. Right? That was not a part of psionics' legacy that we wanted to keep.
The complete psionics handbook in second edition was the first D&D book I ever owned myself, and I remember rolling in my... Like, the DM was like, well, you know you have a chance to permanently lose all of your intelligence, right?
No problem. That just means I roll a new character.
Pretty much. We ran a poll shortly after the Scion was debuted in Insider, and sort of asked, like, well, do you, like, are Psionics part of your D&D game, essentially, because they have this old story. And there were a lot of people who responded, you know, well, they're just like over that line for what I can accept in my D&D, and so they never used them before. But I don't think a lot of the new story stuff had really set in for people by that point. So I assume players, like some of the more recent books, have had more like sidebar story stuff. You think we might see more of that in Yeah,
you'll definitely see, well, you saw it in the first part of Player's Handbook 2, and you'll see something like that in Player's Handbook 3, and Paragon Paths, of course, will speak to that story as well, and some of the other powers. Even a lot of the story can be found even, not a lot of, but you can find fragments of the story of a particular class in the power descriptions, the two or three sentences you get. You actually find a lot of flavor in there.
Another thing we think actually helps Psionix is by moving the monk into that power source, we think it helps give a little hook to the power source for a lot of people. Like folks who might say, well, I'm scared of PowerPoints, or I'm scared of, you know, pseudo-scientific mumble-de-gumble. Well, the monk's fine, though. I got no problem with the monk. He just jumps around and hits stuff.
Right.
Well, and once he's on board in your game, then you sort of say, well, okay, he's part of the psionic tradition. What other parts of the psionic tradition do I want my game to explore? And he sort of can bring his friends along and say, look, you weren't scared of me. You don't have to be scared.
The monk's like the guy at the party, like, you know.
Can I bring my friends?
Right.
Well, yeah, sure.
And to go along with what Andy was just saying, Player's Handbook 3 itself, you know, it's our yearly Player's Handbook. Monk's in it. Scion's in it. Some other new classes are going to be in it. It's like, you know, it's not automatically a separate choice like it was in third edition. Do I want to buy the expanded science handbook or I do not? I do not. Okay, done. This time, you know, I guess you still decide not to buy the Player's Handbook 3 maybe, but, you know, if you bought the first two, you're incentivized to buy the third one and so on.
Again, we want to make sure that Psionix continue to be treated as part of the game as a whole. They are not a side system. It's not a ghetto of characters that don't hang out with the others. It is a part of the game, and by putting it in the Player's Handbook and making it a sort of front and center part of that Player's Handbook, we think that really helps a lot. There was a lot of discussion during the design phase of Player's Handbook 2 of trying to put both Primal and Psionic into that book, because what we were sort of afraid of at the time is, well, if we put Psionic in its own book, is it strong enough for that? Is it compelling enough for that? Or do we need to sort of, you know, put that medicine in with something else sweet? And eventually we just told ourselves, look, no, we have to trust that we're going to make classes and a power source that is compelling enough to people that they're going to find it, oh my gosh, I have to have this. If we don't have that faith in our own design, well, then we need to find new jobs. And we sort of talked ourselves into breaking them apart and allowing each one to shine individually. And I think Player's Handbook 2 benefited greatly from that approach, not having to share space with another power source, and I expect Player's Handbook 3 will have the same effect.
Race selections for the Player's Handbook, does that really strongly tie into the story that goes along with it? Because I know Minotaur is on the cover, and like Gitzerai, and we recently found out that Githyanki are not going to be in it for fear of having too many villainous races. Can you talk a little bit about
the Wildlings too,
the selection of races that go into that?
So, yes, the answer very simply, yeah, if we have a story, we want a race that is going to be suited to that new power source. And if the race is suited to that new power source, then we have to take into account the story that went along with it. So, in particular, the Githzerai you see on the cover is going to be very suitable. It'll be suitable for any class, but it'll also be very suitable to take various of the psionic classes you see in the book.
But that said, not every race is picked for that new power source.
Okay.
We like to talk about how would they interact with it, right? Which of the new classes might they be best at, and sort of imagine them filling that role. But we're also picking races that might be for the other classes in the book that might highlight them a little bit more, or simply races that are so compelling that we want to get them out there, right? There were some obvious picks for Player's Handbook 2. I think Goliath seemed a great fit for Primal. The Gnome, like, well, he's sort of Primal, but really he's in there to be supporting things like the Bard and the Sorcerer, which are more his shtick. So it's always sort of some horse trading that goes on.
So you're not trying to push Psionic Minotaurs on everybody?
Not necessarily, but there's a pretty good Psionic Minotaur combo in that book.
Okay.
And you have a sweet kitchen to go with it if you want to use that. So.
Yeah.
Nice.
And again, that's part of embracing it as, look, there are Psionic Minotaurs in the world of D&D, right? just like there are elves that use divine power, even though they're really more of an arcane-themed race, or Eladrin, I should say. There are halfling sorcerers, even though you think of them more as rogues, right? We want to make sure that people can play a vast range of characters. I am sure there are going to be a lot of psionic dwarven characters, for instance. There's some good fits with that race in the psionic classes. And then it challenges the player to say, okay, this is not a familiar story that I've heard of before, so I need to take the information they're telling me in this book, plus my own imagination, and say, well, why does this guy do this thing, right? If most dwarves, quote-unquote, in your game are fighters or clerics, why are you this other class? What story do you have to tell for them? I think that's really exciting.
Yeah, in fact, that was one of the big things about 3rd edition was like, hey, dwarves can be wizards now, and like, that's a new thing, and so now, pushing that even further, like, look what else dwarves can do.
Yeah. There are always going to be combos that seem more appropriate either story-wise or mechanically, but there's never going to be any shortage of players that want to play just a bizarre combo that isn't super optimal, but is absolutely very playable. Right? That was one of the advantages that we saw, for instance, in getting rid of ability score penalties for races in 4th edition, is no longer do you have to say, well, that guy makes a terrible X because of the -2 to his score. Now it's just, well, he's as good at it as any other average person. He doesn't have the +2 edge that some races do, but you know, that half-orc can make a perfectly fine wizard. He can put the 18 in his intelligence, no problem. He's going to be a little stronger than the average wizard, but I think that's cool. That's a neat story to tell.
Just something, because since the last time we talked to you was even several months before 4th edition, could you just talk about how you feel about how 4th edition's been going and where it's going? And
Obviously, the release of the game last June was an extraordinary relief for all of us who had been working on it. At that point, Rob and James and I had been working on the game for over 3 years. So it was a huge weight just to get it out there and get people playing. In the years since, we've been extraordinarily pleased with the reception we've gotten, the willingness of people to try something new, the people coming out of the woodwork saying, I'd never played D&D before, but now I get it, now I'm playing. I've started games with my kids or my nieces and nephews or, you know, my class. People coming back from previous editions. This is the one that threw me. It's like people coming back from first edition saying, this feels more like the D&D I used to play in 1978 or what have you. That was one I didn't really see coming. I understand it now when they explain it, right? Because the retreat from a lot of the bells and whistles that previous editions put on, and the onerous debt it put on the Dungeon Master to do a lot of work and master the game. I feel like we've gotten the pendulum back sort of in the right place, swinging between Dungeon Master empowerment versus player empowerment. 3E swung a little too far toward player empowerment. I feel like we've got it a good place now where both sides of the screen really feel like, okay, it's my job to help tell this story, and I get a moment to do it, right? Dungeon Master gets it in building encounters and playing through those. The players get it in building their characters, describing how their powers work, describing why they pick the skills they do, and building that personality for the character. Knowing that they're not screwing over the DM by picking these combos, right? They're not. He knows what he's doing, I know what I'm doing, and we both sort of understand each other. We've got this nice detente, and we're both here to have fun.
We know that there's going to be a Player's Handbook 4, and there might be, you know, talking about the schedules there. Psionics were like a sort of a separate thing. So is there any chance that the Chronomancer is coming back?
The Chronomancer, time travel in D&D.
Like the time power source.
Well,
never say never.
Yeah. I think that the reason we'd want to do something like that is we can come up with a good story angle for how it fits into the world of D&D and create compelling game mechanics that are fun for that player and the other people at the table, right? I mean, I think almost any class concept could be done badly. Some of them can be done well. And we also have to ask ourselves, even then, do we need it in the game, right? There are classes that we could do well that we never will, simply because the game doesn't really demand them, right? Are we ever going to do, for instance, a swashbuckler class? It's a great concept, could probably be a pretty good class, but it's not clear to me yet that there's room in the game to wedge that guy in. Same with, like, say, the Scout from 3rd edition, right? The need for that class just doesn't really exist right now. That could change. Our perceptions may change. It's more likely, though, that we'd be exploring totally new areas. Like, D&D's never gone here before. Let's find out what's over there.
Right. So we'd have to keep trying to find a class that you're going to just say, like, no way, we're ever going to do that, because that was an awful idea from the beginning.
I don't like ever saying no, right? Yeah. Because these guys, Bruce and Mike and Rich, James, these guys are always coming up with ideas. Like, I never imagined that monster or that class or that race being cool, but now you just put a spin on it that makes me want to play it and use it in my game.
And it's you know, it goes from design to development to editing. I mean, it seems for whatever reason we really developed a really fabulous system of increasing the coolness of an idea, as opposed to, like, you hear at some corporations where a committee will leech out all the goodness of an idea. I don't feel that at Wizards. I feel it's exactly the opposite. So even a seed of an idea can really take on a wonderful life of its own outside, you know, beyond the initial concept, and often does.
So many of the best ideas grow out of hallway conversations, chats at lunch, standing in line for an espresso downstairs. I mean, somebody will just say, you know what I was thinking about the other day? Or something that came up in my campaign. What if this guy, this monster did X? Oh, I never thought of a monster that could do that before. How would that work?
And you're like, hold on a second, my macchiato's out.
Yeah, and on your way back to your desk, you're mapping it out. By the time somebody gets to their desk, they've designed the concept for this thing, and it starts bouncing around the department. People are like, ooh, that would be even cooler if it did this, and, oh, did you think about this? And next thing you know, it's in a book.
Thanks, guys, for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.